The list of potential candidates for Wisconsin's 8th congressional district seat is expected to grow following the surprise announcement over the weekend that Republican Congressman Reed Ribble will not seek re-election this fall. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8.5 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Thursday, February 4th. We will talk with our first political analyst during this edition of On the Campaign Trail, examining the 8th Congressional District and who may be poised to represent it next. Coming up a little bit later, we'll welcome in a guest pollster from New Hampshire to look at the latest in the presidential race ahead of next week's Granite State primary. And we will welcome your questions and reactions first to Congressman Reed Ribble of Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District announcing he will not seek re-election. What's your reaction to that? Who would you like to see run for that seat? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Arnold Schober, an associate professor of government at Lawrence University in Appleton, which is located in Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District. The 8th covers much of northeastern Wisconsin. Professor Schober, good morning.
Good morning.
So what was your reaction to Congressman Ribble saying he's not going to seek another term in office?
Well, like many other people, it took me by surprise. He has made quite a bit of his campaign pledge to be in for 8 years and out, and for him to announce early that he was retiring was a surprise, given his insistence in the past.
He said that he would limit himself to 4 terms, but this would have been his 4th. So this is announcing early.
Yes, this is the end of his 3rd term, and so it is a year. Well, it's 1 cycle earlier than mm-hmm. I had expected him to leave, because he certainly was very firm in that other commitment. So it is a surprise.
Yeah. So what is he saying? Why is he deciding not to seek re-election?
Well, like so many other politicians, the official reason is he wants to spend more time with his family, which I have no doubt is true. I think some other things went into the decision as well. One of them is, in conversations I've had with him, he has come across as a bit frustrated with how things operate in Congress. I mean, he is genuinely a small businessman up here, and having to deal with an institution that even in the best of days is slow and ponderous and is difficult to move anything, I think frustrated him more than he anticipated going into the job. And that's a frustration that's not unique to him, but I think he just had enough of that. The other element that my guess is went into it is that he was a bit nervous about having to run on the same ticket as Donald Trump. He made a splash by being extremely critical of Trump very early on, and suggested that he'd be a terrible nominee. And I think it would have been difficult for Ribble to run knowing that he was implicitly supporting the top of the ticket. And given Trump's continuing poll numbers despite his loss in Iowa earlier this week, I think that made him a little bit nervous.
Yeah, Congressman Ribble actually said that he would not necessarily vote for Donald Trump as the Republican nominee for president should he win it.
Yeah, absolutely. Ribble has one of his other characteristics as a member of Congress has been he's very firm in thinking and saying, and I think acting, as his own man. He doesn't care much for party leadership, promotion, the party. He's a Republican because of kind of ideological leanings, but not because he loves the party organization. And I think kind of the expectation of following the party in whatever, wherever it may go, I mean, who knows, but was it troublesome to him.
Yeah. We had a listener or two on our Facebook page already commenting that they thought Congressman Ribble was seeing the writing on the wall, not necessarily, well, maybe it's related to Donald Trump being a GOP nominee, the potential GOP nominee, but that he was getting out while the getting was good, that there was going to be Democratic wins in the fall.
That's hard to say. A couple of things have happened. Clearly, the 8th Congressional District has been represented by Democrats in the not unrecent past, right? Mm-hmm. So Steve Kagan represented us, the Democrat, in 2006 and 2008. He won And then in the late 90s, there's also a Democrat up here. So it's not like this is a closed-off seat to the Democratic Party. It certainly leans Republican, but there's options for the Democrats up here for sure. Two of the things that have changed up here since Kagan represented us was that, first, the district has been redrawn. It's slightly more Republican than it was before. It's been moved a little bit to the east. And we had two Walker re-elections in which the 8th Congressional District went very, very much for Walker. He piled up really huge margins in this part of the state, far above what in the 2010 election when Governor Walker was first elected. And my guess is whoever the Republican candidate up here is, if they're able to play to that same kind of philosophy of government, they will probably be safe in November, taking Ribble's seat. Now, if they could also nominate or a Republican that's kind of not like that, and then that would leave an opening for Democrats. But I think the redistricting and the recall and Walker reelection suggest that this district would be kind of difficult for a Democrat to get this. Well, not impossible, but it would be difficult.
Well, let's talk about some of the potential candidates who are lining up to consider running for the seat. There are a number of Republican names being bantied about, including Republican State Representative John Nygren, John Mako, David Steffen, and Andre Jacques among the state representatives. Among state senators, Roger Roth and Frank Lissay. So what jumps out to you about that group?
Everyone wants in, basically. Yeah. I think a number of those names have been and are moving up through the system. Andre Jacquet comes to mind in particular. Roth only recently won the Senate seat up here, the state Senate seat. And I think they are thinking this is a move up. I mean, a career move for them. This is a good Congress is a good gig if you can get it. Mm-hmm. And they can fall back and say, I already represent part of the district, so I have some natural support here, and they can say, I've done X, Y, and Z in the state legislature. And so given that they have some sense of what the district is already like, that's a benefit. I mean, running from one office to another is positive. I think you'll see probably the most viable candidates come. Several of those were from the Green Bay area. There's a big chunk of votes up there, and then Roth, of course, is down here by Appleton. And those are going to be stronger because they have a larger, natural media base than some of the other ones out in the more on the country.
Yeah, I think of Representative Ribble as being, I don't know, more moderate than ultra conservative. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's accurate. He certainly has some strong principles and a clear ideology about what he wants government to do. But he is. It's a small list of things that he wants, and that's what he went for. He's certainly a very moderate Republican. I mean, he went and watched the Super Bowl with President Obama, which is more than most Republicans would dare to even be seen with the guy. So I think that Ribble represents the 8th pretty well. This isn't a really right-wing district by any means. It's much more towards the center of politics, such as we have one anymore. And so any of those Republican successors would probably have to run more to the center than several of them currently are.
On the Democratic side, we have Outagamie County Executive, former Assembly Majority Leader Tom Nelson, considering a run, and former State Representative Penny Bernard Schaber thinking about it. What about the chances of those two?
I think Nelson has a longer track record in government, obviously. I mean, he's been on the statewide ticket as a lieutenant gubernatorial candidate as well. Clearly, he didn't win that one. But he, as a county executive for a large county up here, Outagamie is where Appleton is, he can point to both executive and legislative experience. Before he was in the county exec's position, he represented what was supposed to be a Republican district in the Fox Valley, and he did a lot of legwork, knocked on lots of doors, and was able to carry that district then. So, he knows how to run a campaign well. He knows how to be at all the right events and talk to a lot of voters.
And we just have a minute to go.
Yep. So, I think he has some opportunity there. His difficulty will be that he's very identifiable as a Democrat in a way that some other Democrats might not be. He doesn't come across as, "I'm just kind of a nice, moderate guy. I'm a Democrat, and I want your vote." Bernard Shaber's is very good, again, with the personal retail politics, but her drawback is that she lost the last election she ran in, and so that kind of counts against her. That doesn't mean she couldn't overcome it, but her base didn't quite make it out this last time around.
And we will continue to follow this as, it shapes up a little bit more. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Arnold Schober, Associate Professor of Government at Lawrence University in Appleton, talking with us about Congressman Reid Ribble's decision to not seek re-election and who is thinking about it. Now on this edition of On the Campaign Trail, we will examine the latest issues that are making news as the candidates turn their attention to the New Hampshire primary. We'll talk with our guest political analyst from New Hampshire about the Democratic town hall meeting there last night, where Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders sparred over what it means to be a progressive and other issues making news on the campaign trail. And we will welcome your thoughts, your questions, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Andy Smith, a professor of political science and the director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. And Professor Smith used to teach at UW-Milwaukee. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for being with us, and welcome back to Wisconsin via the radio.
Thank you.
So what's the mood in New Hampshire these days?
Well, it's somewhere between anticipation and Christmas. The New Hampshire primary is much more than a political event here. It's much more of a kind of a cultural happening. It's a thing you do in the middle of the winter. It's something that people will talk about, but it's also something people wait till the very end to make up their mind about who they're going to support. And so there's a level of anticipation, but there's still a lot of people that are just really tuning in for the first time to try to make their decision about who they're going to vote for in the primary.
Yeah, now, you say that people might make up their minds still, but where is it right now in terms of the polls? Donald Trump on the Republican side is the leader, and Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side?
Yeah, we have Donald Trump at just under 30%, somewhere at 28-29%, and then a big bunch of Republicans all huddled around 10-11%, five candidates to be exact: Cruz, Rubio, Kasich, Bush, and Chris Christie. On the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders has a fairly significant lead here. He's got more than a 20 percentage point lead. He's up about 60-33 over Clinton. And that lead has been fairly steady for more than the last month, and he's been in leading her here actually for some months. Makes her challenge of winning New Hampshire in 2016 much, much more difficult than the challenge that she had in 2008.
Are the Democratic voters in New Hampshire largely backing Sanders because he's a neighbor, or what?
No, I think that's kind of campaign propaganda put out by the Clinton campaign. It's more that the New Hampshire Democrats are quite progressive, as are Democrats in Vermont. And the Sanders is successful here largely because it's the same kind of voters that he has been winning over in Vermont for many, many years. He does have a bit of advantage over his other opponents, Clinton and before that Martin O'Malley, in that living in Vermont means that it's a lot easier to campaign here. It's Burlington, Vermont's only about 2.5 hours from Manchester, New Hampshire, the major city here. So you don't have to do as much just driving up and down the highway or flying across country to campaign here. But he's doing better here because he's appealing to the progressive voters in the Democratic Party here much more effectively than Clinton is.
Well, you know, seems to me that in 2008, Clinton was behind. It was believed that Barack Obama was going to win New Hampshire, but Didn't she emerge victorious?
She absolutely did. And I think that's something that your listeners should really pay attention to, because the New Hampshire primary has very, very high turnout. In 2008, for example, we had 54% of the eligible voters actually voted in the primary. That's higher than some states have in their presidential elections. And that means it's not just activists that are voting in the primary, like you see in Iowa. It's just regular people who don't make up their minds until the end. I mean, historically, 35%, as high as 46%, say they make up their minds in the last 3 days, and upwards of 21% in 2012 said they made up their mind on election day. But back in 2008, Clinton had been leading throughout the year before. She had been leading the week before the Iowa caucuses in New Hampshire polls. Obama won in New Hampshire. Clinton finished kind of a disappointing and unexpected third. She slipped behind Obama, or he had a bounce coming out of Iowa. But that dissipated. And so all of the polls showed Clinton losing by an average of 7 percentage points. She won by 2.5. But then again, that's not atypical in New Hampshire. Polls here have, I would say as a pollster, are more often or as often wrong than they are right in a primary, largely because you have so few people or so many people that are still undecided at the very end. The problem for Clinton this year, in terms of replicating what happened in 2008, is that she is much, much, much further behind, you know, close to 30 percentage points behind instead of 7% in the polls. And there is a really competitive Republican primary that's actually getting more press attention than the Democratic primary here. So it's going to make it more difficult for her to kind of cut through the noise that's going on the Republican side to get that last-minute message out.
Well, there was this town hall meeting in New Hampshire last night, and Democratic presidential candidates Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton clashed over what it means to be a progressive. Sanders said while he thought Clinton had done good work in some areas, he did not think that Clinton's record was an entirely progressive one. Let's take a listen.
I do not know any progressive who has a super PAC and takes $15 million from Wall Street. That's just not progressive. As I mentioned earlier, the key foreign policy vote of modern American history was the war in Iraq. The progressive community was pretty united in saying, don't listen to Bush. Don't go to war. Secretary Clinton voted to go to war.
So, Professor Smith, did Bernie Sanders score some points with that?
Well, it is the message that he's been making throughout this campaign. And in New Hampshire, as I mentioned, it's probably 45% of the Democratic primary electorate are what you would think of as progressives or more liberal voters. And I think that if they know one thing about Sanders, or if progressives know one thing about Sanders, it is that he has consistently been much more progressive than really anybody in American politics for years, or on high levels elected American politics for his entire career, really. So he has a long-term record that he can point to that, and I think that's an effective way of hitting at the Clinton campaign by pretty much saying that she's come late to the table on being progressive on issues that are important to more progressive voters.
Yeah. And meanwhile, Clinton responded that she disagreed with Sanders' definition of progressivism, and that she knew her record and what label fits her. Let's take a listen.
I said that I'm a progressive who likes to get things done, and I was somewhat amused today that Senator Sanders has set himself up to be the gatekeeper on who's a progressive, because under the definition that was flying around on Twitter and statements by the campaign, Barack Obama would not be a progressive, Joe Biden would not be a progressive, Gene Shaheen would not be a progressive, even the late, great Senator Paul Wellstone would not be a progressive. So I'm not going to let that bother me. I know where I stand. I know who stands with me. I know what I've done.
But apparently, Professor Smith, do you think the voters in New Hampshire think that Bernie Sanders is the better progressive?
Well, I think the what Clinton was saying in that exchange really illustrates the problem that she's facing. She is having to define and defend herself at the end of this campaign, rather than being able to make a positive statement, kind of a closing argument for voters. There's an old saying in politics that is, if you're explaining, you're losing. And this campaign for the last several months really has been fought on Bernie Sanders' turf. Clinton had a little bit of a bounce in the fall after the attacks in Paris and San Bernardino, when the concerns of voters shifted from domestic issues to foreign policy and terrorism-related issues, where she is seen as stronger. But on economic issues and on issues particularly of job inequality, Bernie Sanders is seen as the guy. And so she's fighting this battle largely on his turf in New Hampshire.
Yeah. Well, what do you think though, when it's outside the New Hampshire primary? She says that that Bernie Sanders is too progressive and unrealistic to be electable and or get things done. Your thoughts about that?
Well, I think that again is potentially very true, and in a general election, Sanders, with a past record of being a socialist and running as a socialist mayor in Burlington, Vermont, and being an independent for years, certainly puts him at a disadvantage in a general election, and that's something that Clinton has been hitting at him in the past about. But in that earlier exchange, just a few minutes ago, she's saying that she's as progressive as he is. Now she's saying that he's too progressive. So it's being fought on his turf. So certainly states after New Hampshire are nowhere near as liberal or progressive in their Democratic electorate. And I think that Clinton will have an advantage going into the southern states, particularly South Carolina. But the one thing that we've seen from political science perspective over the last several decades, going back to 1972 in the modern primary era, is that winning early primaries gives you momentum to winning later primaries. And winning New Hampshire increases your percent of delegates that you win after New Hampshire by 27 percentage points. So just the momentum from coming out of New Hampshire is huge. And I think some of those polls that they're showing Clinton up by fairly comfortable margins in states like South Carolina are likely to swing around pretty quickly if Sanders should have the size of a win that it looks like he might get here.
Interesting. Well, what about the school of thought that minority voters favor Clinton over Sanders?
Well, again, minority voters are going to behave largely like other voters. They're going to look for a winner. That's when it comes down to it in a primary, in a nomination process, you want to find somebody that can win for your party in November. And there's this, saying in sports, winners win and losers lose. And the fact that if Sanders wins these early states, and particularly if he exceeds expectations here in New Hampshire, a lot of those African-American voters in South Carolina are likely to swing around. Clinton had those African-American voters in 2007, early on, before Barack Obama started to gain credibility and before he won the Iowa caucuses. Once he was seen as a credible candidate and as somebody who could win in November, those votes switched around very quickly.
Let's take a call from Bernie in Elkhorn. Hi, Bernie.
Hi, good morning. I'm a Bernie Sanders supporter, and I think that Sanders would have a much better chance in the general election than would Hillary Clinton. But I don't vote for people because they're going to win or lose. I vote for them based on what their record is and what they stand for. And I think that Bernie has been weak in going after Hillary's actual record. Most Democratic primary voters don't know that when she was Secretary of State, she promoted the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And despite what she says now on the campaign trail, she would vote for it, just like she and her husband were behind NAFTA. She was promoting fracking worldwide. She's not an environmentalist. She's a corporatist. She's on the side of the corporations. So she just keeps going back to the red meat of blame the Republicans for everything, and I'll be the first woman president. Well, Barack Obama's promoting the TPP, which is horrible for labor, horrible for the environment, and Hillary's just another one of those corporate Democrats. I think that Bernie just hasn't gone far enough. I mean,
well, what about that, Professor Smith?
Well, I think what Bernie is saying about Bernie mm-hmm. is the kind of thing that real progressives here in New Hampshire have been saying for a long time as well, that Clinton has come rather late to the party when it comes to being progressive. Now, whether that will help or hurt her in a general election, I think is something to be seen. But we're seeing in our polls here in New Hampshire, which is a swing state in general in the presidential elections, that Sanders is actually doing much better than Clinton against all of the Republican candidates that are in the field. So the electability issue in the minds of a lot of Democrats is really kind of closing up, that they're seeing that Sanders is every bit as electable as Clinton is.
Mm-hmm. And do you think Is Clinton making a mistake by, for example, aligning with President Obama on the Affordable Care Act, whereas Bernie Sanders is proposing Medicare for all?
That's a harder one to really suss out, because I don't think very many people understand Sanders's positions on those issues, on expanding Medicare. It's rather new. It's not been something mm-hmm. that's been debated in major political circles. So that, I think, is a potential weakness. And you can see that he has had a more difficult time trying to explain his position on that during debates than Clinton has, and she's really stuck to the let's keep the Obama Health Care Act in place. Let's not try to do something that might damage it. So I think that she's got him on that particular issue.
Speaking of debates, the two candidates will debate again tonight. This was up in the air until just yesterday. Sanders agreed to the event yesterday. He wanted it to be sanctioned. There was all sorts of talk a little bit about this. I mean, at first it was there were only these certain debates that were on like Saturday night, and now the Clinton campaign wanted to have another one in before the New Hampshire primary. Isn't that right?
Absolutely, and I think that's what you're seeing with Sanders kind of dragging his feet on this was giving the Clinton campaign a little bit of a payback. The Clinton campaign had worked very closely with the Democratic Party to try to hold debates at a time when they wouldn't be particularly visible, because they were worried that that Secretary Clinton would have a difficult time in those debates. But as it's turned out, those are, I think, the best her best days on the campaign have been during those debates. She's been quite effective. She's been able to, I think, make her points more clearly than Sanders has. And I think what you're seeing now is that the campaign has said, you know what, we need to get her out in front of an audience more than we have in the past. We don't need to protect her, and trying to protect her actually hurt her as a candidate. So I think they're really moving around that way on purpose, with the idea of really improving her visibility here at the end.
Do you think that this could change things in New Hampshire?
Certainly could. That I think a lot of political observers and the Clinton campaign in particular believe that the debate that happened the Saturday night before the 2008 primary made all the difference, or it certainly started the momentum that moved the race into her favor. There was a question that was asked during that debate that asked her why she wasn't very likable, and how did that make her feel? And she said it hurts her feelings. And then Barack Obama came back, probably with some words that he wished he hadn't said. He said, "You're likable enough, Hillary," with kind of a snarky tone. After that, Clinton performed much, much better in that debate. She made her points clearly. That attack humanized her, and I think it really set off kind of a chain of other events that allowed her to pull back women voters in particular, who were seemingly sliding away from her during those last weeks. So the debate this Saturday or tonight, right here at University of New Hampshire, could really have an impact on how this turns out.
Interesting. I forgot about that. That's right. And didn't she tear up a little bit at one point?
Yes, it was the Monday after that mm-hmm. debate. She was at a coffee shop down in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and somebody asked her a question basically that said, "How do you keep going on with all the stress and how with all of the effort that you put into this?" And she kind of teared up a little bit and said, "It's really hard. I've got so many things that I'd like to be able to do for the country, and this is really hard for me to keep this up." Mm-hmm. And again, it humanized her. That clip was run all day on local and national news, and that's when so many voters are paying attention, right at the very end. And you can see those shifts happen. You don't know that they're going to happen all of the time, but once they're happening, you know something's going to go on. That's why, as a pollster, I really am cautious about saying, well, this is what's going to happen in the election because the polls say X. I wait for the votes to be counted.
We are talking with Andy Smith, a professor of political science and the director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. He used to teach at UW-Milwaukee. We are talking with him about issues making news on the campaign trail in New Hampshire. And we welcome your thoughts and your questions. What do you think about this this debate over what it means to be a progressive between Clinton and Sanders? We will also turn our attention to some of the news on the GOP side of the ticket as well. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On the Campaign Trail on the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with our guest political scientist from New Hampshire about issues that are making news on the campaign trail in New Hampshire. New Hampshire is up next. It's the first presidential primary in the country. Of course, the Iowa caucuses on Monday with Hillary Clinton squeaking out a win against Bernie Sanders in Iowa and Ted Cruz defeating Donald Trump in Iowa. We'll talk about a little bit more about the Republican side of the ledger now, and we'll welcome more of your questions too at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We are talking with Andy Smith, a professor of political science and the director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. And before we get into specifics on the Republican side, Professor Smith, as I mentioned, New Hampshire is the first in the nation's first primary. How would you generally describe the voters of New Hampshire? Is it a red state, a blue state, a purple state, or what?
We're pretty much a purple state in general elections. Republicans still can do well enough to win seats in midterm elections, but in general elections, Democrats have done particularly well. Republicans have only won one presidential race here since 1992, and that was in 2000. George Bush won by 7,000 votes, but Ralph Nader got 22,000 votes here. So that was probably a Gore-Nader win rather than a Bush win. And Democrats have won all but one of our gubernatorial races since 1996, and we have elect our governor every 2 years. So at the top of the ticket, Democrats do quite well. But New Hampshire voters are by and large different than certainly Iowa voters, but they're different than the voters in some of the earlier states as well. On the Republican side, Republicans here are what we used to call Rockefeller Republicans, very moderate. Moderate on social issues, for example, on the issue of abortion. Republicans in New Hampshire are more pro-choice than the country is as a whole. Even Republicans who vote in the New Hampshire primary are more pro-choice than the country as a whole. They're not concerned about things like gay marriage. And the reason for that is that New Hampshire is the second least religious state in the country. Very low levels of church attendance, very low levels of affinity with churches of any stripe. So those social issues just don't play here.
So it sounds like you got a lot of independence there, don't you?
Well, we theoretically do. What we have in New Hampshire, you can register as a Republican, you can register as a Democrat, and you can register as undeclared.
Okay.
But over the last several decades, we've conflated that term undeclared with independent. And unfortunately, we tend to think of those people as independents, like independently thinking if they're going to vote for Republicans or Democrats in the primary, which they can. That is the one thing that New Hampshire allows. It's a semi-closed primary here. If you're a registered Republican, you can only vote in the Republican primary. Registered Democrats can only vote in the Democratic primary. But those undeclareds can choose. But the thing about the undeclareds is the great majority of them are either Republicans or Democrats in how they behave politically. About 40% or so are really Democrats, and they act like Democrats, and they vote for Democratic candidates, and they'll vote in the Democratic primary. And about 30%, maybe 33% are really Republicans, and they vote like regular Republicans. And then those people that are truly independent really just don't vote that much because they're not that political, and they just aren't the kind of people that bother to come out and vote in primaries. So this big 44% is often pointed to as in the press as the big wild card in New Hampshire politics in the primary, that they can go either way and swing the election for the candidate that's able to get their votes. But in truth, you end up with only about 4-7% of the overall electorate who are truly up for grabs between those two primaries. And then more importantly, no candidate has ever won their party's primary here in New Hampshire without winning a plurality of their party's registered voters. So you can't win by trying to depend on independent voters. Some candidates who most recently tried to do that were John Huntsman in 2012, and he finished in the third place. Joe Lieberman tried to do that in 2004, finished in a distant fourth place. And this year, John Kasich is making a play for those independent voters, and I anticipate that he probably won't be close to the top either, simply because there aren't enough of them who are truly independent in your party's primary.
Yeah, and Donald Trump, finished second in Iowa, has a commanding lead over his closest rivals in New Hampshire, Ted Cruz and John Kasich. Why do New Hampshire Republicans like Trump?
Well, I wouldn't characterize it as a commanding lead. In our most recent polling, he's up by about he's got about 28%, and there's about four or five candidates that are all clustered at around 10% or so, and that could move very, very quickly. I think the thing that attracted New Hampshire Republicans to Trump is the same reason that he's been attractive to voters in other states, and that is he's been very blunt. He's spoken out about issues that many more blue-collar Republicans care about, certainly immigration, and he's done it in a way that he seems fearless about the criticism that he's going to get from the press. So in a certain way, he's similar to Bernie Sanders in that they speak their mind. Even if you don't agree with them, you think that they're being straight with you. The problem for Trump, in my view, is that part of his brand, and I think in Trump's case it really is a brand, is that he's a winner. And losing in Iowa really puts a chink in that brand. And I don't know if he'll be able to recover from that. We're seeing that since the Iowa caucuses, he's sliding in polls here. Huh? And it may be that he'll be... he doesn't like being called a loser, and maybe the voters here will start to think of him as a loser.
Maybe that's why he's now saying that he really is a winner. He appeared gracious once the Iowa returns came in, but then yesterday he is now accusing the Cruz campaign of fraud in Iowa following controversial vote mailers and reports that Cruz staffers told caucus goers that Ben Carson was dropping out of the race in order to boost support for Cruz. And in essence, Trump is asking for a do-over in Iowa or a nullification of Cruz's win. What do you make of that?
Well, he certainly got over that graciousness fairly quickly.
Yeah, he did.
I don't anticipate that there are going to be any do-overs or anything like that in Iowa. These sorts of things that he's complaining about, frankly, are fairly routine in primary elections. Even in general elections, they're fairly routine. Is it kind of the seamy side of politics? Yes, but it, as one old wag famously said, politics ain't beanbag. People are fighting to be the most powerful person in the world, and they will often do some things that some of us might think are unseemly. But that's just the way it goes, I guess. And Trump does. Trump is, I think, becoming aware of the world of politics that he might not have been so aware of before.
Yeah, well, Ben Carson did not drop out of the race, but Mike Huckabee, Rand Paul, and Rick Santorum have all suspended their campaigns after their finishes, lackluster finishes in Iowa. Who benefits most from their withdrawal?
Well, in New Hampshire, really not too many people, because not very many people were supporting them in the first place. That's why they dropped out. The highest percentage in polls of any of those candidates was Rand Paul here, and he was only getting around 3-4%. So it's not as if there's a lot of votes that are going to be distributed across the voting spectrum here. The thing I think that will happen is having those candidates kind of out of the mix will make it easier for the voters here to try to decide who they're going to support. It's just if you reduce the number of choices, it's much easier to make a choice.
Yeah, Marco Rubio surprised a lot of people with a strong or stronger than expected third place finish in Iowa. I know Rick Santorum endorsed him when Santorum withdrew. How is he looking heading into next week's primary?
Well, we're seeing that Rubio is getting a bit of a bounce out of his finish there. The problem that Republicans had been facing here in New Hampshire is there were so many Republicans occupying that middle in intellectual or ideological ground. Certainly Chris Christie, Jeb Bush, John Kasich, Marco Rubio, they're all bunched in there pretty close to one another, and they're all fighting for the same voters. So I think voters, again, are looking for cues. They want to find somebody who's more electable and win and doing better than expected in Iowa, I think has caused some of those Republicans who are on the fence trying to choose between those three or four candidates to say, well, yeah, Rubio's pretty good, and they did okay in Iowa. I think I'll vote for him. But again, this could move around very much in the last the next few days.
Jeb Bush had a tough moment during a speech in Hanover on Tuesday. He had finished a fiery riff about protecting the country as commander-in-chief, but the comment was met with silence. And then he told the crowd, please clap. And after some laughter, I guess the audience did finally clap. What's going on with Jeb Bush's campaign?
I think that that exchange is kind of the Bush campaign in a nutshell here. He has not been able to engage the voters effectively. He has not been able to distinguish himself from the other candidates who have similar positions to him. And I think more importantly, he hasn't been able to shake kind of the Bush hangover that a lot of Republicans, both here in New Hampshire and other parts of the country, still have. The Bush name, while making him better known to start with, didn't make him better liked than other candidates. And I think the Bush name was more of an anchor than for him than it was a help.
Yeah. Well, Steve emails asking us to touch on the fact that Hillary Clinton has far more pre-committed superdelegates while Bernie Sanders has less than 50. How will superdelegates shape the primaries ahead? And we have less than a minute, so if you could be brief.
Sure. Superdelegates were created by the Democratic Party to keep candidacies like George McGovern and Jimmy Carter from happening again, people that were seen as unelectable in a general election. And they're coming into play, or potentially could come into play this time. About 20% or so of the Democratic delegates are people who are elected officials. They call them party leaders and elected officials. And Clinton has certainly gotten many, many more of them, but historically they have not come into play during an election. They certainly could this year, as both Clinton and Sanders have enough money and resources to continue this race all the way down. And Democrats allocate their delegates by proportional allocation, so it's really hard to knock the other guy out.
Yeah, well, we have 30 seconds. What are you going to be looking for tonight in the Democratic Party debate?
Well, actually, I look for the NASCAR moment to see if somebody has a car crash up on stage. But I think that both of these candidates have been doing this long enough that we're likely to see another repeat of some of the earlier debates.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Andy Smith, professor of political science and the director of the University of New Hampshire Survey Center. He used to teach at UW-Milwaukee, kind of giving us a sense of what's happening prior to the New Hampshire primary coming up on Tuesday. Thanks to Bill Mertens, to Christy Taylor, and to Nyasia Ellison for producing and directing this program. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.